We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We know that by 2030, 70 million Americans will have turned 65. We also know that today, people who are 85 and older are the fastest growing age group in the United States. We also know that the health needs of the elderly are more complicated than those of younger people. They do cost more to treat. It is more likely for an older person to spend time in the hospital than is for a younger person. All of these challenges, growing challenges, to the healthcare system in the United States. So in this part of Focus, we thought we'd like to try to talk a little bit about healthcare for older folks, very specifically about how the medical profession addresses the needs of older patients. And our guest for the program is Dr. Fola Oluwahimi. He is a physician at Carle in Urbana. His specialty is geriatric medicine. And he's been good enough to come over and spend a little time talking with us this morning. And I have some basic questions I want to try to ask. But of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in with their questions too. Something that I always try to say here when we have physicians on the program is that we can't do diagnosis over the telephone, so there are some limits as to what we can do. But we do programs like this because we think that people always have questions. They have questions about health and healthcare. And it's an opportunity to ask questions, and I know that the doctor would do his best to respond to the questions that people have. And so I don't want to discourage anybody from calling. I just want to make sure people understand that there's only so much that we can do given the format. But I certainly would encourage folks to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send along your thoughts, questions by email. Write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on.
This to start out with, I realize this is a big question, but given what we know about demographics and the increase in the numbers of older people in the population, do you think that the health system in this country is doing what it needs to do to get ready for that?
Yes. Like you rightly pointed out, one in eight Americans right now over the age of 65, and those numbers are set to increase over the next 20 to 30 years, approaching mm-hmm. one in five. There's been a real strain on the healthcare resources because older patients, older people traditionally utilize healthcare much more than younger patients. I believe that changes that have recently been enacted and some of the changes that are set to take place largely with Medicare, the federally funded insurance program, should start to address some of those challenges that we expect. One of the big things for older patients has to do with therapeutics, drugs, and how to be able to afford those drugs constitutes a large part of the problem. So, I don't think everything has been addressed, but I think changes have been made, particularly with this new healthcare bill, that hopefully will start to address some of those issues.
Yeah. One thing that I have read is that there are some people have estimated the numbers of specialists, geriatric care specialists, that we're going to need, and that have said that today probably we have fewer than half, or we're going to have to more than double the number of people, again, to meet this need that we're going to be talking about in the decades ahead.
Yes.
Is that the case? And are there things that are being done to try to encourage people who are in the process of their medical education to go into that specialty?
Yes. Certainly, without a doubt, that would be the case, that more geriatricians are needed. If we're going to be able to meet the shortfall is a whole different issue. Mm-hmm. The thinking has been to, as much as possible, through the cost of training for medical students, to expose them to as much of geriatrics that as they can get in their training. But recent studies are also showing that just being able to say, well, I see an older patient on my other rotations, or I care for them on other specialties, then, you know, you're geriatrics proficient. Studies are showing that that's just not enough, and specific clerkships in geriatrics are needed. My view is that if we're not able to get enough geriatricians in the years coming, at least to get all the other specialties, family practice doctors, general internists, geriatric friendly, and not just primary care, but even specialists, the orthopedic surgeon, the cardiovascular surgeon, because again, a lot of their patients certainly are in the geriatric age group. And so to talk about being geriatric friendly and proficient in the issues that concern them, at least in their care of that patient, I think would be one way, in addition to increasing, you know, geriatric exposure for medical students.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I've read, it seems to be the case that some people feel that for a lot of people, particularly for adults,
yes,
that a family practice doctor, a family medicine physician can probably do a pretty good job of addressing their needs, but that particularly when you're talking about older patients, what the ideal would be much more of a team kind of approach, where you have the involvement of more people who are more specialists, perhaps in conjunction with a family medicine doctor who would be kind of the team leader.
Yes. A multidisciplinary approach is what helps the older patient. For obvious reasons, you are usually dealing with several, not just disease processes. So the disease processes, several of them, respiratory problems, cardiovascular problems, urinary problems, all existing in one patient. So there are several morbidities, you know, you're dealing with. And then on top of that, or along with that, usually social issues, financial issues that don't just respond to the paradigm of here's a problem, here's a drug, you know, bye-bye. Yeah. And so, you know, just reiterating that point that you're very right, that a multidisciplinary approach is what makes the difference.
Certainly people today are living longer, and people seem, generally speaking, to be living longer and healthier lives. And yeah, certainly the point at which we would consider someone to be old 100 years ago, that's very different than it is today. So from your perspective, or say from the perspective of geriatrics, yeah, at what point do you start to think of a person as old?
Yes. Again, we generally go with the Medicare age of 65.
Okay.
But I frequently would tell my patients the 65 or 70-year-old in my practice is my young old patient. And but to answer the question, from 65 onwards would qualify to be, you know, in a geriatric practice or see a geriatrician.
Yeah, I'm sure we could certainly put together a group of people, say, just to pick any age, say pick 80.
Yeah,
I'm sure we could put together a group of 80-year-old individuals, and we could find a quite a wide difference. I'm sure that we could find people maybe who were in their late 70s who would be considered to be frail. We could probably also find people who were in their early 80s who were really in good health.
Yes.
Where the, you know, so the age has to be something that's a little relative.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the focus is on the functionality of the patient, or functionality of the individual. How well are they doing? Like you rightly alluded to, there are people in their early 70s who have a lot of illness and disability that, you know, really makes them function like much older patients, and not a day goes by in my clinic that on average I don't see a healthy 90-year-old, you know, who is out doing things, you know, maintaining their lives, exercising. And so, yeah, there's a wide spectrum, you know, and age is somewhat relative.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there are a lot of things that determine one's health, how long you're going to live, that people have no control over. They have no control over their family history. They can't pick their parents.
Yeah.
And then there are certainly things that have to do with people, how they live their lives, that they do have control over. So if I said to you, well, you know, this person, you're very healthy, 90-year-old.
Yes.
What are there particular things you think that, aside from just the luck of having good genes,
yeah,
that have made it possible for that person to get to be 90 and still really be in good health?
A couple of things I would allude to. I think one, and this is not often talked about, but paying attention to one's health, you know, just paying attention. I mean, this is we're in a country where there's a lot of emphasis on healthcare, and rightly so. But it's unfortunate that we frequently would run into people who are still not utilizing or optimizing the use of the medical system. So I think just paying attention to one's health, even if you have illnesses, but making sure you're seeking help and doing the best to, you know, manage those illnesses the best, you know, at least the best that science has to offer right now. So that'd be one thing to focus on, that I've seen that people who pay good enough attention tend to do well. Exercise always comes up, to be physically active and making sure that aerobically and otherwise that people are exercising, people tend to do a whole lot better. And I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but just the pursuit of happiness, whatever it takes to, for you, David, and for me, we may have different things that make us happy, but mm-hmm. just for individuals to identify that and to make efforts to really define it for themselves and to pursue it, I have seen, you know, that tends to translate to longevity, at least in my practice.
Yeah, that's very interesting, that the idea that, say, the degree of satisfaction that you have with your life.
Absolutely.
Is going to have an effect on your health.
Yes. I see it so every day, you know, because, again, as I relate to my patients, people ask me, well, you know, why do you stay in geriatrics? And I say, you know, every single day I see someone in my office, I'm learning something new beyond medicine. And one of the things I see is people, older adults who've made efforts to really define what a good life is for themselves and to have made, you know, the choices to pursue that, invariably long-living people. There are ups and downs and challenges, but invariably they live long and they tend to do well.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is Dr. Fola Oluwahimi. He is a specialist in the area of geriatric medicine. He works at Carl. He's with the Carl Physician Group in Urbana, and we're talking about healthcare and the elderly. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I don't want to sound like a nag, but I'm sure that whatever we talk on this program about health, that we probably touch on the standard advice that we are all now used to getting about what constitutes a healthy lifestyle. And that if you ask a question, well, what can I do to try to live a long and healthy life? It's a pretty standard list, and I bet everybody can do it. Don't smoke. Watch your alcohol intake.
Yeah.
Have a healthy body weight. Have a good diet. Get some regular exercise. And also, actually, some of the other things that you mentioned, like it's been demonstrated that having good, close, personal relationships, that's really important.
Right.
We also know now, though, that Americans, a lot of them don't live a very healthy lifestyle.
Yeah.
And we have increasing problems with heart disease, diabetes, mm-hmm. that are really preventable.
Yes. Somewhat.
Somewhat. Again, I mean, it does indeed, you know, family history has a lot to do with it, but how you live has a lot to do with it. And I guess I find myself going back to this question about, you know, what's it going to mean when we have so many people in this country who are over 65? And are we going to be seeing even more lifestyle-associated problems like more heart disease? We're going to see more stroke. We're going to see a lot of more people with diabetes and things like
right.
that.
Well, hopefully not, David. For one, when you look on the one hand that, you know, we have the baby boomers, a very large cohort in this country, mm-hmm. starting to get into that geriatric age, one, you know, shudders at the sheer volume of that group of aging adults. But on the other hand, I think the healthcare system providers generally have and continue to make efforts in terms of health education to help people to, like you said, the list is well known. But I think there's more effort going in that direction from down, you know, right from the clinic down to, you know, up to public health to get people to focus on those things and to really try to do those things. And I think, I mean, for instance, cardiovascular disease, like you said, number one cause of mortality in this country today, but those numbers continue to decrease. The sheer volume of mortality that used to come from cardiovascular illness has been on the decline as people focus on diabetes control, weight control, because all the risk factors, again, like you are modifiable, can be modified. Mm. A lot of the illnesses, chronic illnesses, are not illnesses you can cure. At least for now, science is working really hard. But, you know, we don't cure diabetes as of now. But we can manage diabetes very well. We can manage hypertension very well. And when you effectively manage these chronic illnesses, and then people have life expectancy is just as good as someone who didn't have those illnesses. So I think the effort put in that direction would hopefully balance the numbers that are coming just because, you know, people are living longer. Mm-hmm.
I think that people have really, one of the things that's happened maybe over the last 30 years or so is people have changed the way they think about aging and what constitutes being old. And I think that part of that, and I'm sure that this is also a challenge for medicine, but for everyone, is to be able to distinguish between the effects of disease and the effects of aging, and that there are conditions that people may assume are somehow part of the normal aging process that are not.
Right, right. I it's such a wonderful question. I'm thinking of where to start. I frequently would tell, you know, I say that I'm not sure who said this, but said growing old is not for sissies. It's not, you've got to be tough to grow old because there are certain changes that are inevitable, no matter how much exercise you've done. Take something like osteoarthritis, for instance. While you can do some things to mitigate it, but it's invariably a disease of wear and tear. And so people have, part of what we do is to help to set realistic expectations that growing old really is not for the faint-hearted, and there will be changes that you can't do anything about, but to make the best of it and accept some of these changes with grace. And of course, like we said, science is continuing to move ahead to address some of the things that we traditionally have thought nothing can be done about. Mm-hmm. So having a healthy balance, realizing that, well, some of them I can change, some I can't, I think really, again, helps how people view the aging process and how they respond to that individually, because it's such an individual, such a varied response across the spectrum. And I think it's also a major part of the effect of illness is just how well patients respond or individuals respond to the changes that they see as they get older.
Yeah. Well, would there be, say, an example of a particular condition where you know that some people would just say, well, you know, that's just part of getting old and you can't do anything about it, whereas you would say, no, there actually are some about this particular thing, there are actually some things that we could do about it.
Right. You know, the one that just comes right to mind is memory loss. It's traditionally people have thought, well, as you get older, you forget things, you know, you slip up. And I'm always quick to tell those I come across that dementia, which is memory loss that's significant enough to affect how people have functioned and how they function, is not a normal part of aging. And to encourage loved ones, individuals, or people, patients, not to blow off complaints of memory loss. And so if you have memory loss that's concerning in a loved one, a parent, a family member, or even in yourself, I mean, a lot of people, like I said, the baby boomers are much more educated than, well, traditionally, the older patients we've seen, to, you know, just be insightful enough to say, well, this is not how I've been, and to, you know, pursue help, mm-hmm. particularly in the area of memory loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that particular case, though, what I suppose that it may be that there could be several reasons why, some maybe that you could address, some not.
Right.
Are there some particular things, say, what would you do when the patient comes in and says, look, here's this problem, and it just seems like I'm really having a serious problem, and a year ago I would have said, no, I didn't have that problem, but it's now here, and what can we do about it?
The first thing, of course, is to ensure that there's a reliable or a significant other person who has also noticed changes, mm-hmm. a spouse, a son, a daughter, part of the social network, who can corroborate that concern that, yes, something has changed about his or her memory and how they are functioning. And that's a very, very reliable indicator that this is something that needs to be pursued further. If we have such a history, then the office tests and screens that have been validated in the community and in academic settings and research settings that can point us, that can further, you know, validate that perhaps this is memory loss that's much more than normal aging. There's a simple office screen, the Falstein's Mini Mental Status Exam, just a series of questions, and it has limitations. I'm very quick to. I want to add that of it in and of itself doesn't diagnose memory loss that's concerning. I'm talking of dementia right now, mm-hmm. but when you take that in the context of a good history and a reliable family, caregiver or significant other, referring or speaking to the fact that something has changed about how this person is functioning. And to really be able to determine that the person is functioning at a lower level than they had previously done, and it's all attributable to memory loss, then when you put all that in, you know, as a composite, taking that as a composite, we can 8 times out of 10, you know, confidently make a diagnosis of dementia. I'm also quick to add that there's so many other things coming up right now. Very recently in the news, we had about a biomarker, which has always been the question, well, how can we, how do we make a diagnosis? Mm-hmm. But there's now at least a way that physicians can use a biomarker from the spinal fluid to diagnose dementia, Alzheimer's disease. There are several other types of dementia, but at least in Alzheimer's disease. And there are so many other things in the pipeline. One thing just to mention quickly is brain imaging that highlights some of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. Again, that's still in research, but certainly in the foreseeable future, that would be here with us to enhance our diagnostic ability for Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah. I think this is definitely something that I wanted to ask you about, because I'm sure that if you ask people, what is it about getting older that worries them the most? I'm sure that a lot of people would have near the top of their list the possibility that they would develop Alzheimer's or some other sort of dementia. For a long time, I think it was the case, even though, you know, you could do some tests to people's mental functioning and you could ask about how it is they're able to carry out their daily activities. But I think for a long time it was the case that the only sure way to diagnose Alzheimer's disease was postmortem.
Yes.
By after a person had passed, then taking a look at their brain. And I think now, as you say, we're starting to get more kinds of screening so that the physician would have the advantage of, at some earlier point, being able to do a test.
Yes.
And say, yes, we believe with some level of certainty that this person is going to go on and develop dementia.
Yes, it's coming and will get better over the years. Like one of the things has been the spinal tap, which recently got FDA approval, Looking at specific proteins, it's the process is to take some fluid from the back, some of the fluid that circulates around the central nervous system, and to analyze that for certain proteins that are the signature of Alzheimer's disease. But the problem, here lies a problem, at least for now, and which we hope the next couple of years will help us resolve, is not everyone who has that protein will go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. And so the question is, and even that test right now is not standardized across clinics. And so we don't want a situation where people are running into their doctors asking for this test without any risk factors, so to speak. But as time goes on, I think with the right patient, someone who has memory loss, who it might be unclear if this is Alzheimer's disease or something else, certainly that test will have a lot of utility. It's still quite invasive. How much of this we will be able to use in everyday clinic situation, unclear. Mm-hmm. And that's why I lean towards the brain scanning technology that hopefully with less invasion, that would be more acceptable to providers.
Yeah. Yeah. I have another caller here, just very quickly, though, to follow up. The big question is, if you do get to a point where you have a good way of screening,
yes,
and you can say to somebody, I'm sorry to have to be telling you this, but you have Alzheimer's or you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease, what do you do? It seems that, and now at this point, what we have for available treatments, there's not very much.
Right. But and we're hoping that if we're able to effectively screen, I believe the pharmaceutical companies will then step in, you know, to look at various agents that may then delay the progression. Mm-hmm. We know that there's usually about a decade between the onset of the signature problems in the brain and the actual symptoms of dementia, and so it's a very long time to it's a window of opportunity. And to answer your question specifically, we're hoping the pharmaceuticals, once we have a good screen that, you know, this is really a biomarker of this future problem, they can step in with, you know, various drugs to address the process and modify the disease. You're right. The agents we have right now are largely symptomatic treatments. They do not alter the cause of the illness. They do not modify the disease process. But hopefully, again, that will change with time.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Fola Oluwahimi. He is a specialist in the area of geriatric medicine at Carl and Urbana. And we have someone with a question, and certainly we'd welcome others. If you're in town here where we are, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller in Urbana, line one.
Hi. First of all, we're one of Dr. Fola's patients, and we think he's awesome. So we just wanted to make sure everybody heard that. My dad is one of those 90-year-old forces of nature that he sees. And I was just scribbling down some notes here. I think that we found several things that really helped us. A couple things. One, when he was diagnosed with dementia, but we didn't go into denial. We got him in right away, and we got him on the medication, which is honestly one of the biggest challenges because the Alzheimer's is a big stigma in their mind. But once we got him on medication, that was terrific. Two, we got him on, my dad went on antioxidants, vitamin E, as of age 59, because I was working as a chemist in a lab with vitamin E, and I told him about him, and ever since he was 59, he took antioxidants. And I have to think that might have helped him. Three, purposeful physical activity. If you told my dad, hey, go exercise, he'd look at you like you were nuts. But if you told him, hey, go garden for 4 hours, he'll be out there, and he's got a better resting heart rate than I do, and an EKG that's better than mine. Also, in our family, we have an attitude where age is not a disease. We got that actually from our veterinarian, actually.
Yeah.
And, we're not planning any family trips to Mount Everest, but we just don't look at age as something that is, you know, a cross to bear, mm-hmm. or something that we just write things off. So maybe that helps us. And, you know, the last thing, and it was something that Dr. Fola said earlier on, is that you learn from them. There are certain things he does that just drive me nuts, but when I stand back and look based on results, who's right? He's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man washes his hair with bar soap, But he's age 90, and every time he goes to the barber, they have to thin his hair because he's got a full head of hair. So who's right in that situation? So I just wanted to make a comment and say that, you know, we're very fortunate. We know genetics have a lot to do with it, but I think a big part of our equation is that we're lucky enough to have Dr. Fola in this community.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind comments. I think you just alluded to all the key points. First of all, I think you have a very good support system, and it sounds like you're very innovative in the way that you approach, you know, caring for dad. And I think, you know, that's another point, Dave, that people have to be innovative and think about, you know, if there's no plan for the 90-year-old all day long, and all he has to do is sit in front of TV with hearing loss and macular degeneration that affects his eyesight, he's bound, or he or she is bound, to have behavior issues and spells of, you know, more confusion. And so the point of being innovative in how to engage the older adult, you know, cannot be overemphasized. And I think, you know, the caller, you know, talked about purposeful physical activity. Find something that, you know, they enjoy and find ways around it. I remember one of my patients who was very, very demented in terms of just, you know, being able to engage cognitively on any level. But he enjoyed tennis and had always enjoyed tennis, you know, as a young man and growing up and his adult life. And his wife went great lengths to make sure that every other day he could get a game of tennis, be it for 15 minutes. So much planning went into that, but it really kept him calm. So I think that point is well taken. And just to speak a little about the medications, like you said, they're symptomatic, but it does make the trajectory. We know dementia, at least for now, we don't have a cure, but it makes the trajectory of decline a whole lot more bearable for families and for the patients themselves, helping them maintain dignity and, you know, helping them, you know, go along that course in a much better way. So I think the point is well taken. These medications do help. And antioxidants, there's a lot of research behind that. Vitamin E definitely has been well studied and does make a difference, particularly if, you know, patients are able to get it in the right dose. So thank you.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome. Questions, comments? The numbers again, 333-9455. That's our local number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to have you talk a little bit about medications generally, because I think one of the things that is true is that we have a lot of older individuals who are taking multiple medications. And we do know that there can be consequences of various kinds of interactions. You may not quite know what they might be, but the things really do add up. And if you have someone who's taking five or six or seven different kind of medications, it can be complicated just to remember how you're supposed to take them.
Yes.
But then when you get all those things mixed together in your system, there might be kind of unpredictable results.
Right. And the situation, like I alluded to, older patients who have four, five, six chronic illnesses, each one of them requiring one or two medications, I mean, with a lot of evidence to prove that the medications help, how do you navigate that for the older adult? How do you decide that, well, five is what you'll get and not the sixth one as required? It takes a lot of judgment. Mm-hmm. But that being said, one of the ways to... And you're right. You know, once you start to get over six medications, it's concerning just because of drug interactions and how they can, you know, affect each other in terms of efficacy. And oftentimes, the best way is to work closely with your patient and to also involve family members and loved ones to help, you know, manage those medications. For one, on the part of providers, there are a lot of systems right now in prescribing that will alert you if you are prescribing something that's likely to interact with something, a medication the patient is already on. And so we have a number of these new types of systems in place. But at the same time, there are concerns on the part of the patient just to make sure that they take the medications right. Mm-hmm. and not, you know, double dose or take, you know, a whole week's worth of medications in one day or that kind of thing. It takes a lot of balancing, but I think the main thing is to have a lot of hands-on management from the physician to family members to the patient themselves as much as they can do. It's interesting, there's a lot of technology coming right now to help the older adults in terms of pill reminders and that kind of thing. So I think just putting all that in context should hopefully reduce the safety issues that come up from polypharmacy. But you're right, it's a big concern. One of the leading causes why patients have to be hospitalized is, you know, drug-drug interactions and adverse effects on the older adult.
Yeah. And is it the case, I'm sure that I have read this, that there it is possible that one of the consequences of this kind of interaction when you're having people taking 5, 6, 7 different medications is that you can actually get symptoms that sort of look like dementia?
Yes. Yes. Which we call delirium. That times when the medications can so interact, or just the withdrawal. In other words, patients who are on so many medications and maybe omit one, particularly in this class we're talking about sedatives, may forget to take one, for instance, could lead to a kind of withdrawal illness that looks like dementia, where people are confused, they hallucinate, they see things, and could be a major reason why people get into the hospital. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, certainly that's a concern. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it's dealing with two competing interests where, you know, there's evidence out there that says, you know what, you have congestive heart failure, you will benefit from this class of medications, that class, at least 3 or 4 medications. And then trying to decide, well, you know, who should not get that. Again, I think it's a partnership with the patient and the physician to say, you know, this is what, you know, this amount of medication I think is good enough. We'll watch things. And I find out that if my patients hear from me and just say, you know, it's not like we're not aware of this other pill that you could be taking, but you know, let's see how things go for a while. Let's, you know, monitor closely. You know, let's not outweigh the benefits with risks. And a lot of, invariably, my patients respond to that. So I think a lot of judgment comes into it on the best course of action for that individual patient.
Well, I'm sure that it when you're prescribing in any case, when you're prescribing medication, there are going to be questions. Different people respond differently to different medications. One will work on one person, not so well on another person. So that there may be some trial and error when it comes to dosage, and that you could see that in a case where you just have one person taking one medication,
yes.
Where also you might have a case where that person, you come in, you do your diagnosis, you're pretty sure what's going on, you're saying, okay, here's something, take that, and chances are it'll probably be fine, and maybe that person goes off if they take it right.
Yeah,
it works just fine.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a case like this where you have a person who has a number of conditions, they're taking a number of medications, the business of getting it finely tuned enough,
yes.
It's probably a lot more complicated. It requires a lot more working with the patient.
Absolutely.
To say, okay, do this. How are you doing?
Yes.
Maybe, okay, try this. Let's see how you're doing now. And that it's a much more, the time you have to spend and the communication you have to have, it's going to be much, much different.
Absolutely, David. It's a much more intricate process, but that's what it takes to reduce morbidity. That's what it takes to reduce side effects. It's really time put in. And one of the major principles of geriatrics is to always start low, start with a much lower dose. In a lot of the studies that were done to authorize these medications were done in much younger patients. And a lot of times we generalize the results from younger patients to older adults. Well, things are changing. A lot more studies are involving geriatric patients now. But a key principle is always to start at a much lower dose. And like you alluded to, invest the time, bring them back for, you know, 2 weekly visits. How are you doing on this? Can we then make a dose adjustment? And invariably, that will at least not completely mitigate all the risks, but at least will reduce and lessen the risks involved.
Yeah, it's interesting how for a long time the process of doing research on drugs, they're tested on adults.
Yes,
and then they're prescribed for older people. They're prescribed for children, and prescribing for children kind of went on this assumption that they're just like small adults.
Yes,
we'll just scale the dosage down for their body weight, and we assume that they will respond to the same way that adults do.
Right.
And that may in fact be the case, but that is not necessarily the case. And I'm sure that other kinds of issues get into the fact that when you have older adults, your metabolism is going to be different and your response is going to be different.
Right. And there are changes that happen for the older adults that particularly in the field of pharmacology, for one, the kidneys oftentimes are not functioning quite as well. And so the clearance of a lot of these medications have been compromised.
Uh-uh.
And so just, to think, to be very cautious with the older adult with medications and just not see them as, young 50 year olds that have aged. No, we might be dealing with a whole different biochemical person, so to speak. And again, I think it goes back to the fact that time and attention is what makes the difference, in giving the best outcome to older patients. Yeah.
We have a couple of callers here. We have just about 10 minutes. Our guest is Dr. Fola Oluwahimi. He's a specialist in the area of geriatric medicine at Carl in Urbana. And questions are welcome, and we have a couple. And next is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi. I'd like you to speak a little bit to the older generation's use and abuse of alcohol. My 87-year-old mother was not an alcoholic until after my father died, and then she kind of poured herself into a bottle. And I was in looking for ways to help her. Her generation used alcohol as a social issue. I mean, they had one drink every night. But once my father was gone, there was no sort of control factor, and she was very much alone. But, she hates taking pills, but she'll have a drink, and of course at 87 she's much more affected by it. And there really aren't very many services available for elderly people who are utilizing alcohol as a drug.
Yes, and for so long we failed to realize the scope and the scale of the problem of alcohol in older patients. But that is certainly changing. We're certainly a whole lot more aware. And it's also a reason for a much more complicated hospital cost if patients have to be hospitalized because unknowingly to providers, they can actually go into withdrawal. So I just wanted to make that point. The risk, I think one of the things to be aware of is to know who's at risk, who's most at risk. And once you at least have a risk profile, you alluded to the fact that, so patients who espouse, a loved one, widowed patients at particular risk, women and men. But I think losing a loved one really, creates that risk situation where they can then resort to alcohol and start to use that in excessive amounts. The one strategy is to perhaps, speak to the health risks of consuming excess amounts of alcohol. And there are now, resources out in the community that I think young, middle-aged, and even geriatric patients can, certainly access. I think the key thing is to engage your doctor or her doctor, engage, your primary care provider or whoever her physician is, and, walk along with a physician to, get help in that direction. It's a tough problem to address, but I think, again, with a multidisciplinary approach, a family, social workers, and the provider, the physician, you certainly can get good results. And there are resources in the community now that will certainly work with older patients. So I would say check with the primary care provider.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions, welcome. We have maybe about 5-6 minutes. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. To go back to something, you really touched on this, but I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about when you are dealing with an older patient, how you think about the benefits of of treatment, of particular kinds of treatment, and how that compares with somebody who is younger. And for example, just in some of the reading I did, one of the examples had to do with statins.
Yes.
And the fact that, say, you know, there are pretty clear benefits. Say you've got somebody who's 50-year-old man, and maybe he's got some risk factors for heart disease. So there's probably pretty good justification for somebody like that to be on statins. Then say you have somebody who is just, you know, again, to pick a number, say somebody who is 80.
Mm-hmm.
Is there really a benefit to that person to be on a medication like that? And how, from case to case, you decide, you know, what's really a beneficial treatment and what's not?
And I think the best approach is, as you alluded to take it on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the benefits of cholesterol lowering in an 80-year-old are not as much as in a 50-year-old. But having said that, again, we've alluded to the fact that the risk we want to avoid, or what we don't want to run into, David, is having patients who, even though they're 80 or 90, but they're still functional and still, you know, can do things, to deny them the treatments that they perhaps may benefit from. And I think one should focus on the individual patient and make sure that, you know, the judgment on whether to start to use a particular class of medications is individualized. Because a lot of my ADLs, as I sit down speaking with you now, are certainly doing very well, and I would hate for them to have a stroke. And they would hate to have a stroke either. So I think it's on a case-by-case basis. Definitely the body of evidence would question some of these therapies. And if in situations where there's clear-cut evidence that there's no benefit, and we can talk about some of those things, then one should definitely, not do them or start them or give those medications. But where it's not really clear-cut, I think it should be an individualized decision. I quickly would add that often one of the things we run into is the problem of, like you said, several illnesses requiring so many medications, and then the issue of finances come in. Mm-hmm. And you begin then to decide, do I lower the cholesterol or treat the dementia? You have a fixed income, and we've got to decide on where this, amount goes in terms of healthcare dollars. And that's where I would say, well, help my patients decide. Perhaps it's more important to treat this than to treat that. And again, they need guidance, but to avoid being ageist and not offering old patients or older patients medications that have been proven to be beneficial, I think is just what I want to talk
sure.
about. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's take another caller. Here's someone in Mattoon. Line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm wondering about those individuals who have HIV that are living longer, as well as people living longer in general. What is the relationship or comorbidity of HIV in old age? Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Great question. With the treatments available for HIV now, and the fact that people are able to, the medications are quite effective and there's a lot of longevity, HIV is not necessarily exerting a greater negative influence on all the other illnesses if they're under proper management. Granted, for now, a lot of older HIV patients continue in the specialty clinics of, specialty HIV clinics. And they get all their care, I think, in that specialty situation for providers that are seeing them specifically. But I think, again, with the advent of newer, more effective HIV treatments, patients are doing just as well as they would if they did not. They're living just as well as they would as, if they did not have HIV. And I think you then address all the other problems. If they have diabetes or high cholesterol, does not, change what you would do for them. You would treat them with the same medications and would treat them, with the same goals in mind, in terms of treatment.
Well, again, I hope that helps. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about a minute and a half or so. This may be a very strange and maybe even disturbing way to think about this. But I'm motivated having, again, read some articles where people in the field were kind of thinking about or talking about a treatment and what you decide to treat in this way. And they're saying, well, one thing that you kind of have to keep in mind, particularly, I guess, when you're dealing with the old, is that when you treat for particular conditions, one of the things that you're doing is, in effect, is you're selecting for cause of death. by preventing and maybe again it's an unrealistic hypothetical, but you know, what do you do if you have somebody and you prevent them from having it, from dying of a heart attack, but then they go on to develop Alzheimer's disease?
Yes.
Have you done them a favor?
Right. And one has got to be careful, and it's a great question, not to impose, you know, one's value system on another patient or on the patient. I always, and I think my colleagues, all of us who practice in geriatrics, and even all my colleagues who see older patients, make sure we have the discussion with the patient. What's really important to you? Mm-hmm. Patients will often make known what they consider to be of value to them and which treatments they really don't want to have anything to do with. I think my our roles are to present what the options are and to, you know, help make a decision or help, you know, provide the information to make a decision. But ultimately, it's a patient's decision once, you know, the facts are presented. But the point is well taken. Sometimes it seems like you're selecting the cause of death. But oftentimes, and a lot of the times, it's really about compressing morbidity, helping people live better lives, helping our patients do well as they age, helping them age successfully, and to control for all the variables we can control for. Make sure, you know, if the stroke is preventable, prevent it. If the diabetes can be better controlled, control it. Yeah. And so ultimately, once they have that, they can, make a decision as to which way they want to go.
All right. There, yeah. We're going to have to leave it. Our guest, Dr. Fola Olwuhemi, he is a specialist in the field of geriatric medicine at Carl. He is part of the Carl Physician Group in Urbana. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave,
for being here.
Thanks.